Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Guys, welcome back to Magic TV. My name's Craig. It is 9 o'clock on a Tuesday, which means it's time for another Talk Magic. This is episode 9. And the question you've got is, after last week, after the world champion of magic, after Sean Farquhar, how do I top that? Well, I top that with our very own UK Sean Farquhar, the legend that is Steve Deller. Hey, Steve, how you doing, mate?
Hi, Craig. I'm good. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thanks very much. I'm wonderful.
Good. That is good to hear.
Good to see that you're on brand with the Steve Deller in the background.
It's just so you can't see the awful magic tricks piling up that I'm rehearsing.
Well, you know, I know that you're really busy, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come onto the show. Obviously, you and I know each other very well,
yes.
And you know, we'll talk about that as part of the interview. But I mean, I think one of the reasons I wanted you on right from the very beginning is you are a legend in the UK magic community. You have done so much. No, you have. It's true. You know, and I think sometimes I know you very well. And even sometimes I have to remind you of all of the awesome stuff that you've done.
Oh, God, okay.
And it is true. But there's a lot of people that are on this channel that are newer magicians that might not be aware of everything that you've accomplished. And I'd like to start almost at the very beginning and talk about how you got into magic, because you were in magic from a very young age, because you even won the Young Magician of the Year, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
And so I'd like to talk about that. How did you get into magic?
So I have, like everyone has an uncle that knows a few tricks. Okay, so not like a professional magician, not someone that's ever done it for money, but he could do things like the French drop, and he had a thumb tip with a silk. And I was about 3 years old when he started showing me. It was the French drop was the first thing. So a coin vanished and pulled behind the ear. It's cliche, but it's exactly what happened. I was obsessed and kept asking him to show me how it was done. And he did the magic mantra of you don't reveal tricks. So I just begged him and begged him. And my mum basically said to her brother, look, he's not going to give up. Will you just show him how this trick works? He showed me. I was absolutely hooked. I practiced it at 3 years old. And then on my fourth birthday, I had a Houdini's magic set. And then for Christmas, I had a Paul Daniels magic set. And from there, it went to Marvin's magic. And it just progressed all the way up.
That's fantastic. And when did you start taking it seriously? Because obviously everybody, you know, everyone's got that story about, I got a Marvin's magic set, but yeah. A lot of people just leave it at that, while you then went and won Young Magician of the Year. So how did you transition from where everyone else was to, you know, winning the magic set for Young Magician of the Year?
Well, it really did become an absolute obsession, in that when I was younger, as soon as I could read at an appropriate level, I started reading magic books, and I wouldn't read any fiction books. And to this day, I mean, I haven't read like a normal fiction book since I was about 7 years old. So I knew I was hooked. And then you get people asking you when you're young, like relatives, what do you want to be when you're older? And my words were always, I want to be a professional magician. And of course, like you said, people kind of grow out of it, or most people do that have magic sets. So they laughed it off. And as the years went by, I kept saying, no, I want to be a magician. And I got better and better. And when I was 13, I went to see Paul Daniels do his one-man talking show, where there was like an ask the audience section. And I said, I want to be a professional magician, Paul. What advice do you have for me? And he said, join a local magic club. In fact, there's a guy here from Shrewsbury called Jeff Ray in the audience. And he goes, afterwards, we'll all get together and you two can meet and you can join the magic club. So from there, I was invited to join the Shropshire Magical Society. I was the youngest person to join at the time because they didn't have a junior section. So I went straight into the adult section. I think I was 14 years old when I entered their newcomers competition. And there was a few newcomers. I was the only child, but I won it. I liked the idea of winning things from that moment on, because I am not sporty. I'm not incredibly academic, although I have a good mind for mentalism and lie detection and things like that. But I thought this is something I can win at. So I had a little taste of it. So then a couple of years later, I won the Shropshire Magical Society's close-up competition. I then won their stage competition. I went in for the IBM close-up and I came third or second, something like that. I then won Young Magician of the Year at the Magic Circle. Before Young Magician of the Year, I then did the IBM again and got first place when I was 16 years old. I then became Young Magician of the Year for the Magic Circle. Then the year after that, I came second at the IBM and got the Rovi Trophy for the second time as well. And then the year after that, I became first at the IBM close-up again. So I've won the IBM twice and I've come second twice and I've won Young Magician of the Year. And now I have 25 first place magic awards.
Which is incredible. I don't know if there's many people that have got that many first place magic awards.
I don't know. It's a bit of a really cheeky marketing ploy. On my emails and things, it says the UK's highest awarded magician, so the person with the most awards. I have kept that on and will probably keep it on until I'm challenged. Because I 25 is such a big number that I don't know. And this includes, obviously, this isn't just local competitions, but it does include those. So local, regional, because I've won the Midlands Champion of Championship twice as well. So I've got regional, local, national, and then Young Magician of the Year was international. So I feel like I can claim that title. Until someone comes to me with proof that they've got 26 awards, I'm going to just keep it on the site.
I remember the first time I actually met you in person. It was backstage at one of the IBMs that you won. And I'd never met Steve Deller before. I'd heard of Steve Deller. And I was backstage. And I was like, oh, hi, Steve. I'm Craig. And it's then that I realised just how focused you are at winning. Like, I was really confident I was going to win that thing. And no... No. I've then learned ever since then that if you're in a competition with Steve Deller, or at least from my point of view, if ever I'm in a competition with you, I'm losing. That's just...
I definitely don't have enough of an ego to believe that for one second. And also, when I go into a competition, whilst I've done all the maths in my head and I've ticked all the boxes for why I think I can win, which a lot of people that enter competitions don't do, which is... why I've won so many, I think. But I never go into a competition thinking, ha, I've got this. I don't have that big of an ego. I very rarely talk to people about the competitions. I don't mention it when I work, for example. I probably should. You being like an absolute marketing guru would be telling me that I need to mention stuff like that. But because I don't have an ego like some people think I do, that I'm a little bit more humble than that.
Well, why do you enter competitions? Is it because you love the competition, you love the fights? Is it because you want the social proof, you want to be able to say that you've got more? Is it because you just, it gives you an end goal? Because I would argue that at this point now, you wouldn't need to enter a competition again. You've set, everybody knows that you are formidable when it comes to entering competitions, but you still enter them today. You still do.
For me, it's definitely not about trying to be better than other magicians in that respect. But it's like, I used to do music. I used to play the cornet, which is like a little trumpet for people that don't know. And you get in music, you get grades, and your grades tell people how good you are. Now, in magic, you're going to get the people that will never enter a competition, and they will argue they don't need to enter a competition in order to be good. True, very true. And also competitions don't equal work, okay, which I'm very well aware of. But what competitions do for me is when I win one, I go, oh, I am doing something right. I must be at least good at magic if I've got an award that beats a room full of people or several heats of people. So for me, it's like my music grades. The more awards I have, the more I feel like I'm valid, that I've got a place in magic. And like I said, people that don't enter competitions, that's absolutely fine. In fact, some people have really strong views about not entering competitions, and that's fine. They don't obviously need to justify to themselves, but I, deep down, am quite an insecure person. So knowing that I've achieved something within a profession that doesn't really have goals to achieve, I've kind of made my own goals.
That makes a lot of sense. And what advice would you give people that are watching this, that want to enter competitions? They've got the same mindset as you. That, you know, they want to enter a competition. They want to prove to their peers, whatever the reason is.
Yeah.
Is there any advice that you can offer someone?
Yeah, absolutely. The best thing I can say is you don't just put together a competition act thinking I'm going to do my best 4 or 5 tricks, and if they're the best, then I'll win. Because it doesn't always come down to the tricks, or even your routining, or even your patter. What people forget when they enter a competition is there's a lot of criteria. I've been a judge for quite a lot of competitions now, including Young Magician of the Year, and there's criteria sheets, and this is the same with the IBM. You'll get out of 10, you'll be scored on things like appearance. So immediately, if you turn up in ripped jeans and a t-shirt and all your judges are of an older generation, you might get a 1 or a 2 out of that 10. Now, losing 9 or 8 points just because of the way you're dressed will basically mean you can't win the competition. So it doesn't matter from that moment how good your act is, you're not going to win. So you've got things like appearance, magical content, originality, skill level, things like that. These are all things out of maybe 5 or out of 10. If you're scoring low on just 1 or even 2 of those, then you've said goodbye, no matter how good you think your magic is. So the presentation, the way you look, the originality, the skill level, the routining, they all have to be scoring 8, 9, 10 in order for you to even place.
That makes a lot of sense. And that also really helps. I'm going to ask you another question now, yes, which I know you've been asked several times before.
Right.
As somebody who wants to prove to themselves that they are good, mm-hmm, would you ever consider going on BGT? Because I know for many, many years, BGT was this whole, oh, Simon Cowell hates magic. But yeah, since Russ Stevens has been involved, I think that's flipped. And I think
he's really elevated it, hasn't he?
Really has. And I think the perfect example is the BGT final, where magic dominated. You know, there were 6 out of 10 acts, and 6 of them were magicians or speciality acts. So I don't think it's the whole Simon Cowell hates magic anymore. I think he's mellowed since he's had kids. And I think Russ looks after all of the magicians that goes on BGT. So is that something you would ever consider?
It is. And I don't know how to say this. And I think I could win it. I genuinely do. But the problem for me, and this isn't a cop-out, so if I never do it, this is actually going to be the reason. I know people will say, well, if you think you can win it, you should enter. But it's not that simple. I actually have a really very kind of I have a family history thing, which I know that if I became famous, which is kind of the reason I can't be famous, all that stuff would come to the front. Okay, I know that I would have everything about me, my personal life, past events in my family history, things that have literally made headline news before, they will be dragged up again. So if I ever did Britain's Got Talent, I would need a really good media manager that would ensure that these things don't come to light. I know that sounds really cryptic.
No, no.
But that's as much as I can say.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense. So maybe, maybe not. I totally get that.
I'd be more inclined to do it as a magic group or as 2 people, Craig. I'd be more inclined to do that, but I am genuinely worried about my personal life being spread around a bit.
Pull a Mark Spellman and just put a mask on.
That's what I need to do, but then I'd be a Mark Spellman copy.
No, you can't do that. Yeah, good point.
And he was brilliant.
He was. Well, let's continue. So you have won lots of competitions. You've absolutely smashed it. And then you make the decision to move from Telford, which, if people don't know, is a sleepy little town in the middle of absolutely nowhere in Shropshire. And you go to London, which is a massive change. You know, it couldn't be two polar opposites when it comes to a place. Can I ask why you made the decision to move to London?
Mainly because first of all, I wanted to join the Magic Circle, which I managed to do anyway, because I got automatic entry from the Young Magician of the Year win. And then it's that whole thing of if you're going to do something somewhere, you want to do it in a capital city, and London seemed the right choice for me. I didn't realise until I started looking into it how expensive it was going to be to live there. But I got residencies almost immediately. And at one point I was doing one residency 5 days a week. And then I think I had three or four other residencies. So I was basically doing magic every single day. So from the off, I started seeing London as the land of opportunity. And I really was gigging and I was honing my craft. And I was getting better and better and better. But the one thing I did notice is all my friends, some magic friends from London that I used to speak to all the time, they were very, very encouraging when I lived in Shropshire. But when I moved to London, there was kind of shut doors on me. No one would pass me work. People would stop giving me advice. It was kind of like, well, now you're in our territory. We can't do that. And so I felt like the dark side to magic in that respect. And it was kind of upsetting because I moved when I was 18 years old and I was really enjoying the magic side, but I kind of lost my magician social side. And it was really, really tough to kind of think that people can be like that. I wouldn't go as far as to say they were two-faced, because I don't like calling names or saying names on people like that, but it just felt cold. It's like someone switched a switch. Like I was too close to them.
I totally understand that. I do. And that's the problem sometimes. Magic is meant to be a brotherhood, but it's also a business. And a lot of the time, you know, your competition are also your friends, and it can be very awkward.
Well, that's just it. A lot of these people are still my friends. If people might start messaging me saying, I hope I wasn't one of them. Well, I'm not going to tell people whether they were or weren't, because I actually value my friendships that I've still got with these people. Like you say, and like you know more than anyone in the business side of magic, it is a business. We're all there to make money. So I guess when you become someone's competition, the natural response is to switch off a little bit. It's a bit like I don't readily give advice to other magicians. I'm not doing so. It's a similar thing, but I will give people advice on their magic. But the marketing side, I leave up to people to figure out on their own. Because when I moved to London, that's exactly what I had to do. And plus, in my local area, it's a case of not wanting to lose work because you're giving it away to everyone else.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Now, while you were down London, I'm hoping you don't mind me bringing this up because I'd like to talk about this.
Go on.
I'm going to say one word: misdirection.
Oh yeah.
Okay, can we talk about that? Is that okay? Yeah. Amazing. So you became a very well-known drag act magician. How did that come about? Where did that come about?
It came about, so I was in the Two Brewers, which is a gay nightclub in London, near to where I lived in Clapham. And basically there was a postcard on every table that said drag idol. Have you got what it takes to win Drag Idol UK, be the number one drag queen? So I thought, yeah, I've never done it, but it's a competition. That's literally what I thought. I thought, you know, I haven't entered a competition for a while. So yeah, why not? Let's do that. So with my friend Lee Hathaway, I put together an act. I worked on my makeup. I bought myself a nice little dress, some knee-high boots, and I put together a raunchy magic act as Misdirection, the female magician.
I've seen pictures. You look great.
Yeah. After, well, thank you. But my very first appearance, I did not look great. And in fact, it was only the week later when I was out the back having a cigarette with some drag queens that were about to go on stage at the same venue. So not the competition, but they were paid to be there. I was out having a fag, just chatting to friends, and they were right next to me. And I heard one of them say, I heard that the drag magician was really, really good, but the makeup apparently was shit. So I was stood next to them and I just went, oh, that was me. That was me. And they went, oh, honey, do you want makeup tips? And I was like, yeah, go on then. So I went round to, it was one of their flats in London, and we spent the whole day working on makeup. And that was Crystal Decanter and Kelly Miles, the drag queens that go as CK. They were absolutely fantastic and they were instrumental. So between them and Lee Hathaway helping out with music and design and stuff like that, I managed to come second in the UK as a drag queen who had never done it before.
That is exceptional. And I know that you ended up doing quite a lot of work. I mean, and obviously you don't do it anymore, but for a long time, you were very busy as Misdirection, weren't you?
Yeah, incredibly so. I worked as Misdirection for a nightclub a few days a week. I then had a residency as Misdirection doing close-up magic at the Cellar Door in Zero Aldwych. And then I did a lot of corporate gigs, just handing out sweets and flyers and things at big trade show events. And those were big money events. It was really good. I then managed to get onto Michael Vine's radar. And it was at the time, I went for a meeting with him, and it was at the time when I was going to give up doing Misdirection. He did not want to know Steve Deller, but he said, if you carry on with Misdirection, we'll make you the next Lily Savage. But the thing is, I couldn't do it. I mean, the money for a one-off gig like a corporate, the money wasn't quite as good as doing magic, but it would take me an hour to get ready and half an hour to take it all off. So like time-wise, money to effort ratio, it just didn't seem viable to continue. And plus, you know, when you've got hairy legs and you're wearing three pairs of tights, it really hurts after a while.
Imagine. But you know, it's the perfect example of you make your own luck. You know, you why do you enter competitions? Why do you do this? Well, you know, look at what that led to, you know, and you never know what's going to be around the corner when you do this stuff.
True, because, you know, it's a good reminder, so thanks for that. But for 2 to 3 years of my life, that gave me a comfortable life. It paid my bills and then some, so it was good. But there came a time where I had to retire Misdirection. Plus, when I was doing Misdirection's Magic Cabaret, which is what it was called, at nightclubs, sometimes I wouldn't be on until 2, 3 a.m. in the morning. And that's when the 45-minute show would start. So I had to become a nightclub magician and basically deal with really drunk people on a nightly basis. But it gave me how to work with hecklers and things. So it was a good experience, but I don't think I'll ever do it again.
Mm-hmm. But you then moved on to a different character, and I said the words Big Brother and clown.
Yeah.
that was incredibly popular. Everybody was talking about that. And how did that come about? Like,
right. So I have an obsession with masks. So I love like face masks and horror masks and things. So when I was doing really well money wise from the magic and Misdirection, I started buying some high-end masks, and one of them that I designed was an evil clown, because I love clowns as well. When I was young, as well as a magician, I wanted to be a clown in the circus, so that was something I forgot to mention. So I think I paid about £1,000 for a mask, right, which sounds a lot, but it was made of silicon. It's hand painted. It had hair on it, and it was a really good mask. So then I started approaching nightclubs and a horror nightclub called Cirque du Soir in Mayfair, and I started doing magic as Mr. Snuggles, the evil clown. Andy Nyman had seen me do Mr. Snuggles on one occasion, and he goes, "Oh, I know what this would be good for." So then he rang up the producer of Big Brother and said, "By the way, talk to my mate Steve, because he does this evil clown thing and it'd be good for a challenge." So after Andy Nyman did the introduction, I got these messages saying, "Hi, we've got this idea for a challenge. We want you to come in and scare one of the housemates." And that was in 2010, Celebrity Big Brother, I went in. It got so many complaints. It got people that were scared of clowns were switching off their TV. Apparently, Eureka Johnson had to have therapy when she came out of Big Brother because of me.
Are you serious?
Yeah, seriously. It was all in the paper at one point. And then the other thing was that my appearance in 2010 made it into the 100 top moments of Big Brother of all time, which was really good. And then a few years later, 2013, they asked me to go back in. So I did it again, but this time I spent about 3 hours in the house, as opposed to the 5 minutes, which was originally going to be half an hour. But in my ear, the producer was going, get out now, because it looked like it was going to get violent. So that's why if you watch the clip, it's like 5 minutes in 2010, and I have to leave. You kind of see me on the camera go, and that's when in my ear, they just say, get out now. And it sounded like, it sounded like I was being attacked. So I quickly ran to get out of the place. Then in 2015, they asked me to do it again. But at that point, I said, no, Mr. Snuggles has had his day.
But it was insanely popular for a very, very long time. It was good. You seem to have this ability, Steve. You're a little bit like the Madonna of magic. You're constantly reinventing yourself, and you're constantly coming up with new ideas that haven't been done before.
I think you've got to, really. I mean, you've seen my close-up. My close-up magic hasn't changed for like 15, 17 years-ish. So, and I won't change it because I can't think of anything better to put in it. But doing a different character gives me a chance to work on completely new material and completely new acts. It just keeps me a little bit sharper.
Which is great. Now, one thing I want to pick up on, which goes hand in hand with, changing and pivoting and moving in a different direction. Throughout this whole interview, you've used the word magic. At no point have you said the word mentalism. Yet now, I would say if I did a poll on Facebook and I said, you know, what would you look at Steve Deller as? Most people would say mentalism. And you do a lot of mentalism right now.
Yes.
Where did that transition come from? How did you go from being an exception? And I know you still do magic, but it's the sort of the thing is massively moving in the other direction in terms of magic versus mentalism.
Yeah.
Where did that decision come from?
There's a lot to this, really. So I've always loved mentalism. Since when I was younger, I remember at the IBM seeing Sean Taylor doing a lecture, and it just that got my interest. And then when I was performing at the Magic Circle Centenary show, I got to see Mark Salem, and that sparked my interest. And then the popularity of Derren Brown. So Derren Brown saw me perform my Cups and Balls years ago at a convention. And after that, he wanted to go for a coffee. So we went for a coffee and we were chatting about it. And I remember at that point saying, because I think his first TV show had just come on TV. And I remember saying to him, do you know, I like magic, but I'd like to be more of a mentalist. And Derren just explained how much more difficult it was. So I kind of left that to one side, because also I was young, and Derren had the right idea in that it's just less believable if you're young. You know, when I used to teach at the Young Magicians Club, which is like the Magic Circle's youth initiative, because mentalism is so popular, you'd see a trend in it. Now, I loved mentalism at this time, and I was already starting working on it, and I was putting mentalism stuff into my stage show, not so much my close-up. But I remember seeing The Young Magicians and thinking, oh yeah, do you know, a nine-year-old doing mentalism is a little bit strange to watch, to be honest. Especially, not strange if they frame it right, but it's the ones that go, oh, I've spent years studying body language and psychological techniques, and I'm watching it thinking, oh, but you're like nine. So when did that start? So it wasn't, so I was had this battle in my head that even at say 19, 20, 21, that I was still too young to pull off being a mentalist. You know, many would disagree with me, and a lot of people have done it younger, and especially these days they are, but I didn't feel right doing it. I was still creating, I was still adding stuff to my stage show, but I wasn't willing to call myself a mentalist. I think the first time I started calling myself a mentalist was when I was about 28 years old. I thought that was the perfect age to do it. I thought it was more believable. And that's kind of the time where my stage show went from being like 90% magic, 10% mentalism, to 80% mentalism and 20% magic. And now, as you know, because we do our fantastic show together, my part of the show is 100% mentalism. And yeah, that's what I want to do. The other thing, though, with it, no one searches for a mentalist for their weddings, you know.
No, they don't, not at all.
You think getting magic gigs for weddings is hard enough. People going, oh, I need a magician for my wedding. Well, no one Googles mentalist or mind reader. They just don't. They just don't. I think it's the same reason quite a few top-end mentalists still like have magician as their tag. Because everyone knows what a magician is. Even though it's more popular now, not everyone knows what a mentalist is.
It's very true. It's very true. And you've been quite outspoken on Facebook and socials, and especially in magicians groups, about how mentalism, the traditional mentalist, are trying to make people believe that you've got these otherworldly powers. You are really against that, aren't you?
I am, in one sense. I am in general. But I think for me, it's the new wave of mentalists that are so preoccupied with convincing their audience that mentalism is real, that they forget to have fun, they forget to make it entertaining. It's no secret that I'm not a big fan of propless mentalism. Mainly because I don't like procedure, because, okay, maybe I haven't seen enough of it, and I know people will disagree with this so much, but every time I see propless mentalism that has some kind of procedure, I'm there going, even though I know mentalism, I'm going, gosh, surely people can see through that. Do you know what I mean? You're looking at it thinking, can you? I know people are going to watch this, and I'm going to get messages, and people are going, yeah, but you should try this routine, or it's not when I do it. I just haven't seen propless mentalism that doesn't look like it hurts, basically. Do you know what? I've got to stop ranting about this, Craig, because every time I'm interviewed for anything, I end up ranting about propless mentalism, and that is not what this is about. I love mentalism, but and the only reason the propless thing came up then was because you were asking about like the people that take it too seriously. I do not really want people to believe that I have super mind reading powers. Okay. I don't mind them believing that I am doing some kind of magic with some kind of body language, with some kind of lie detection, because I am actually a lie detection person anyway. Without mentalism methods, I know when people are lying and telling the truth. It's just something that I've been able to do my entire life. So that's my propless. I could literally do that, and I people find it funny. My friends find it funny to ask me to tell them who's lying and who's telling the truth, and I can literally do it. But when it comes to mentalism, I'm not trying to start a new religion, which is what a lot of these new age mentalists are trying to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with you. And you know, we're not going to go into propless mentalism, but my attitude is you owe it to your audience to do the best possible performance that you can do. And
yeah,
there's no way that propless mentalism is going to be better than if you've got all of these different tools at your disposal.
Yeah.
And a perfect example is, you know, your coin in hand routine where you guess the coin. I think you've got the best coin in hand routine I've ever seen, because I love the way that you predict beforehand. You predict the whole thing beforehand, but they don't feel like you predicted it. And it's just great. But from the audience's point of view, it is propless. You took a coin. And they're not seeing a prop. It's not like you've got a big thing on stage that you're, from their point of view, it is propless. It's not because you're using a prop, but surely it's the perception of the audience that's most important and not the perception of the performer.
Wow, you said that so well, Craig. That is 100% my thought. I mean, when I'm doing mentalism for people, they might see a pen and some paper, and that to them is propless. Same with the coin in hand. They don't know I've got a gizmo or a gadget. So it still looks mentalism-y. It's still natural. But I might spend £100 on a prop that can achieve an effect and make it 10 times cleaner than if I did the same thing using a myriad of sentences, a bit of guessing, some anagrams, and I don't know. I don't have the brain power for propless. So I honestly forget things immediately anyway. But I like traditional techniques. I love modern techniques. I think the way mentalism's moving forward is a great thing. You know, there's mentalists out there that won't touch the e-mentalism stuff, or the electronics and that. But there are also those that won't touch billets, and those that won't use a pocket writer. There's different people in different mentalism camps. And the weird thing is, we don't seem very united in the idea of making mentalism entertaining and fun. Instead, people are more interested in what methods they're using, and they're only making the method cleaner for themselves, in their view, cleaner. They're not making the effect better for the audience, and I don't get that way of thinking.
Ultimately, it's the effect on the audience that the most important thing. You know, what is the experience that the spectator has had? Totally agree. Which brings us nicely onto the other thing that you're very well known for, which is creating magic, which you've been doing for many, many years. I remember the first time I sat down and watched Work and Play, and that was a massive inspiration to me. If people haven't seen it, it is your first DVD project and is exceptional. But since then, you've gone on to release products, a lot of products with Alakazam.
Yeah.
But you've also published a lot of stuff yourself. You've done some Alakazam academies. You've done At the Table with Murphy's. You've got so much stuff out there. Mm-hmm. How did the creating thing come about? Was that something? When did you decide, you know what? I know I'm really busy being a clown and being a drag queen and taking over every residency in London and doing this and doing that and doing the other and helping the young magicians in. But you know what? I'm going to start creating magic as well.
It's the same way people like yourself create. You want routines that are going to be fun, powerful, entertaining. It's necessity, basically. It's like one of my best-selling effects, Will to Read. That came out of the fact that I love the free will principle. I like the, you know, whoever's reading it gives you two different predictions. I liked that, but I didn't like, I like having to use marked objects and things like that. So I wanted a version of that to carry around with me, that used a new principle that made it cleaner. I can't give too much away for those that don't have it. But it feels like every choice is completely free and the outcome is in front of people the entire time. This is why it's such a big seller. I then decided to add my book test to it so that you basically have one page that will achieve three different effects if you add a bit book as well. And that's become popular because it's mentalism that has props, is direct, and it fits in your wallet. So I think when I created it, I wanted all those things for me. And then I thought, well, if I don't sell it, which is what happened with my book test, if I don't release it to the public, someone else is going to have the same idea and they're going to release it before me. So not wanting what happened with the book to happen, I thought Will to Read has to be released. And then from that moment, I did things like the book test managed to get released, even though someone had released a version similar before me. But mine predated theirs. But my God, that is one hell of a big story to cover. And then most recently was the deck of cards.
Absolutely. And I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the Night Flight deck, because obviously myself and Ryland reviewed it recently. And
yes, thank you for that. It was a brilliant review.
Oh, well, you know what? It's an amazing deck of cards. I mean, people can go back and watch the review. Ryland performed a simple... he performed what him and I thought was a very simple marked card routine. But...
I bet it fooled people.
I can't tell you the amount of people that messaged me going... How did that trick work? It doesn't make any sense.
You did it well.
So talk about how did the Night Flight deck come about? Because it came out a few months ago now, and it's very quickly become like the main deck for a lot of working professionals.
It really has. It's more of the main deck for mentalists than magicians. And the reason for that is because they're plastic. So it came about very much like all the other stuff, just necessity. So when I work, like gigs, weddings, things like that, I would always use a marked deck. Now, my favorite cardboard marked deck is the DMC deck, but you're paying, I think with the red decks, I was paying like £13.50 a time. And then the green decks came out, I think they were like £17 a time. So I thought, do you know, as a mentalist, I don't need to be able to fan the cards, to flourish them, to do all this kind of stuff. I would rather just have a marked deck that instead of lasting me 1 month is going to last me 3 years.
Yeah.
Right. And I thought, and I play a lot of poker, and in poker, like in most casinos around the world now, playing cards are plastic, they're PVC. The technology that is now used to create PVC cards is really up there. They're much better than the shiny, cheap, waterproof type that you get on eBay. These are actually made for casinos, and I went to a company that makes for casinos. So I thought, let's do a plastic mark deck, but let's not stop there. Let's make the marks bigger than they have been on any mark deck. Let's make them really obvious when you know, but completely invisible when you don't know. I then thought the deck needs to look familiar. So we'll put a photo up on the screen of how similar it looks to the bicycle deck. Different enough, but similar. Okay, so it's got like that generic playing card feel. The marks are huge. I'm sure Craig will put something on screen showing the markings. Yep. But I also did a one-way star in the middle. And then there is black and red indication, okay, which tells you whether the card's a red card or a black card. So if you're doing mentalism effects like out of this world and that kind of thing, it makes it like 10 times easier. One of the feedbacks I got from people that didn't have the deck was, if you've got the markings so big, surely they can just see if it's red or black by reading the marking. You can, but it's honestly not as quick as the separate little dots that tell you whether it's black or red. And that has become one of the favorite features. But this is what the deck looks like. Very generic. There's nothing on the box to say that it's a special deck of cards. And for those that wanna see, they do shuffle.
Oh, they do. In fact,
they shuffle well.
They shuffle. Ryland can shuffle that deck better than he can a normal deck of cards.
It's probably because they're more flexible. So good for his little hands. Yeah.
And they are just great. And I know that when you decide, because you didn't go through a magic dealer with this, you published these yourself and created it yourself.
Yes.
And I know it was a big financial risk for you at the time.
Massive. Yeah. Yeah. Basically, I used mine and my partner's entire wedding fund to fund having the cards made. And
I'm sure happy with that.
Well, it was a tough decision to make, but we made the money and then some, so it's all good. That money, well, until COVID, that money was back safe. and now it's a little bit drained again, unfortunately. But yeah, so I initially had 500 decks done. I said to myself, if they sell within a year, I'll be really happy. Well, we sold 200 decks in the first week, and then all 500 within 4 months, I think. And I've had another 700 made, 244 of which have gone to Murphy's. So if people want to get the deck and you're not in England or you have a favourite Magic dealer, check it out, search the Night Flight deck. You'll be able to get it from them because that still helps me out. The more we sell, the better. But if you're in England and you want to visit my shop, it's Della Shop. That's D-E-L-A shop.uk. And if you're in the UK, it's free postage. But it's not if you're elsewhere, which is why if you're in America, Canada, China, Japan, places like that, check your local Magic dealer. It's very likely they'll have it if they've got a Murphy's account.
And you know what? You've talked about how great they are for a mentalist, but I'm a magician and I use them. And you must have had magicians in mind. I mean, you put a double backer in there, you know.
Well, I put a double backer in, but I was thinking of mentalists using it.
Oh, okay.
But Craig, I will allow you to use this pack for magic if you so wish. No, the only reason it's marketed more to mentalists is because they're marked and yet they're only 30 quid. Which sounds expensive, but if you think the deck will last between 3 to 5 years, not 2 to 3 weeks or 2-3 months, it's actually the cheapest mark deck you'll ever buy. Also, this deck, this was my prototype deck from 2.5 years ago, which is still my everyday deck.
Says it all, right?
Still my everyday deck. I've washed this deck about 10 times now, because with a bit of soap and water, you can wash it. You just dry each one on a towel, a tiny bit of fanning powder, and they spread like nothing. Well, they spread better than anything. They spread better than new with a tiny bit of fanning powder. Also, can I touch, Craig, on the reason I did it in blue?
Yeah.
Right. So people have bought it. They, you know, like I said, we've now sold 500 direct and 244 to Murphy's, and I'm still selling a few every now and again. The biggest complaint I get is, why are they not in red? Okay. Now, most magicians, I realise, use red cards.
I personally don't like the word red.
Yeah. Let's not go there. I thought it was fabulous, Craig. Most magicians like red. And the only reason for that, statistically, is because you can write on the back for certain tricks and it'll be seen. Okay. Also, because bicycle blue is almost black. It's such a dark blue. So I thought, since this deck isn't made to be written on, why not do them in blue? And I've done them in a kind of light blue, which is more reminiscent of the old stud cards from Walgreens. Okay, because people used to love that blue. So that's what I've gone for here. The other thing is, I research, and if you ask most men what their favorite color is, and remember, I know there's lots of women in magic, but it's a male dominated art. Most men's favorite color is the color blue. And I think this would be the same with magicians. If you ask a magician what your favorite color is and you're not thinking of playing cards, they're more likely to say blue, purple, green, that kind of thing. It's very rare you're going to get someone to say red. So that's why the decision was made with the blue. However, if you guys rush in your drones to buy these cards now, and I sell enough to get them printed, I will do red, but I'm going to do a cardboard edition and I'm going to make them really good value.
Oh, great.
But you all have to go out and buy a deck, or buy direct from me, buy from your favourite dealer.
Right. And I know that you've got lots of other projects coming up as well as, you know, I've seen very cryptic images going up on your Facebook page of the symbols on playing cards and little wallets made out of leather. It seems that you're on a mission right now to bring good quality products out and, you know, some incredibly cool looking stuff that you've got.
Thanks for that. I've got the leather wallet is basically going to be for ESP cards, okay, and that is going to but it's really, really good quality, like you wouldn't believe, like thick leather, thick hand-sewn, wouldn't fall apart in years. Basically, that's going to be really cool when they come out. I should get them in a couple of weeks. But I'm releasing a new type of ESP deck. Now, I've held off doing this because Alakazam have just released an amazing ESP deck. And then my friend Baz has just released a plastic ESP deck. So I was like, oh, are we all ready for another ESP deck? I was like, no, I'll leave it a bit. So I'm going to give it another few weeks. I'll let everyone buy their ESP decks, and then you come back and buy mine, because mine's different. It doesn't use the normal symbols. It's got different symbols. It's got things like a light bulb, a sand timer. These are marked. They're 100% plastic, and they are each a different colour. Okay. This now means you can do personality readings based on colour, or you can do personality readings based on the image that people choose. It makes match-up effects more fun. Like I said, the cards will last forever. They're marked in a very clever way. I also can't wait for people to see that. They can be seen from a very thin spread, which card is which.
That's great.
So that'll be coming soon. And they'll also be reasonably good value.
That's awesome, as everything. And are you bringing anything else with out other than the cards? And do you have any other projects on the horizon with different magic dealers or tricks or so on and so forth?
I do. I'm not sure who's releasing it yet, but there is a big one. I think it could be as big as Will to Read.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it's mentalism, and it's close-up mentalism, but it can be used on stage as well. But hidden on stage, it would look propless to all the people that want the propless feel. Look propless, but it's, yeah, I've designed a unique utility device, which I really believe every mentalist would get an absolute kick out of. I can't say too much because whilst the idea has not yet been manufactured, it's stealable. So I can't say much more.
Okay. But watch this space.
Watch this space, and keep an eye on your favorite magic dealers for Steve Della products, but keep an eye on dellashop.uk because everything goes up on there first.
Awesome. Now I want to wrap things up with a couple of other questions that I want to ask you, and the first one is, you've talked throughout this interview about youth. You talked about you winning the Young Magician of the Year. You also talked about how you worked with the Young Magic Circle. There are a lot of people that are on this channel that are younger. We have a lot of, because I keep an eye on the analytics, there's a lot of younger viewers on this channel. What advice, for somebody who's worked with, you know, the Young Magic Circle, and what advice would you give a young magician that's so passionate about magic and, you know, they have that goal of becoming a professional?
Oh, wow. God, that's a question, isn't it? I wish I'd known beforehand. I would have prepared something. What advice would I give? Keep doing it. Keep doing it. Learn via whatever's easiest for you. So if that means books, then great, read books. If, though, you don't like to read, can't read very well, are not inspired by reading, find it difficult, maybe you're dyslexic, get DVDs. And don't ever be ashamed of the fact that you're not reading magic books. I love magic books like the next person. I think I own about four. Right. But DVDs for me helped me learn. So that's the first thing. Choose the medium that works for you. If you can't learn from DVDs either, then join a local magic club. Get some one-on-one tuition with someone you respect, with someone whose magic that you admire. Also, try to be original. So don't copy other people's presentations. Be yourself, have your own personality, make it fun. Don't become a boring magician. Don't become a sleazy magician. Do magic that's age appropriate. Okay. So no 20th century bras, please, if you're 10 years old, nothing like that. You've got to find magic that suits your personality. And the great thing is now there is a lot of what I would call younger magic out there, the stuff that does make you hip, does make you cool, the kind of thing that illusionists and people like that are releasing. So yeah, do magic that makes you happy ultimately, but make sure that everyone you show it to has a good experience.
That is fantastic advice, Steve. That's exactly what I was hoping for. That's wonderful.
Hey.
Now, I want to ask you, it would be impossible for me not to interview you and not to mention Phantasmagoria. We have to mention this.
Because this is the best project I'm working on.
I completely agree. I am biased, obviously. But do you want to fill everyone in on what Phantasmagoria is? Because obviously it's a different thing now to what it was back in the day. And because this is kind of a really exciting thing that we're both doing at the moment. So
yeah, absolutely. For those that don't know, Phantasmagoria is mine and the wonderful Craig Petty's stage show. Mm. I used to do a show called Phantasmagoria that was produced...
Hang on, before you start it, I will edit in a show reel so they can see a minute version of kind of the rough idea. I'll edit that in right now.
Welcome to Phantasmagoria,
a state of mind in which things, Craig, are beyond imagination.
What's better, magic or
mentalism? Changed our hat.
Ah! Guys, drop the curtain, let go of the rope! Ah! There's a technical term for this, it's called a cock-up.
Everybody should come and see this show. It's great. Absolutely fantastic.
You feel that is... You're going to cover it with any cup in a moment.
I love the format, mentalism versus magic. Never seen that before.
But I'm going to try and find that card using ninjutsu. Throw the cards on the count of three. 1, 2, 3, ninja!
I think anybody could come and enjoy this tonight. Just brilliant. Steve and Craig, awesome.
So there you go. That's a rough idea of what Phantasmagoria is all about.
It's exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
I used to do Phantasmagoria. So not as a one, well, it was a one-man show, as in that I was presenting it, but each week I'd have different guests come on and do bits. So we've had Romany, we've had Michael Jordan, we've had John Archer, Faye Presto, the list goes on. And it was produced by my friend Stephen Baker, very good friend of mine. And it ran in London, and then it was so successful we ran it in Brighton for about a year. That all stopped after a while. All good things have to come to an end. And then when I moved back to Telford, I was close to my friend Craig Petty. I believe you've heard of him, Craig.
Yeah, it's not many people like him, I think, but yeah, I've heard of him.
No, he just has strong opinions. But yeah, I wanted to get more into stage stuff, and then you and me had reconnected, and I thought I don't like working alone anymore. Okay, and then I thought, who better to do a show with than Craig Petty? And I thought, I know, I'll leave the magic to him, and I'll do the mentalism. So for those that don't know, Phantasmagoria is now a competition: magic versus mentalism. Okay, which is an idea that Craig came up with, and it works so well. We can't reveal what happens at the end, because it's different every time, but the magic versus mentalism plot plays out really well for the grand finale. You guys will have to come and see the show in order to understand what we're talking about. But the concept and the feedback we've had so far has been absolutely fantastic, hasn't it, mate?
It has. We're just about to really kind of launch this at the next level. And then this little thing called COVID happened and set all that back. But, you know, the nice thing is, and I talk about this on the channel all the time, we have everything in place. So, you know, as soon as things get back to normal, and they will, trust me, we are ready to literally turn that tap on and just go.
And the nice thing is, I know that you've been doing the same, but I've been more creative during this time, and every stage piece I've been working on during lockdown, I've only been thinking of it for Phantasmagoria.
Well, I invested in, and I think I'm one of only about 30 people in the world that have got one of these, I invested in the Quantum Logic Routine by Tom Stone. specifically for Phantasmagoria.
That's exciting.
So, yeah, which is probably my favourite routine. So yeah, we're ready to go, and it's going to be bigger and better than ever before. Absolutely. My question is, I've got to ask you this. When you told everybody that I was going to be the guy doing Phantasmagoria with you, how many people rang you up and said, are you nuts?
Yeah, I mean, I was verging on death threats, I think, at this point. I had people saying, why Craig? And then I would give all the great reasons why I chose Craig. And I would have people just, you've got a reputation, Craig, and it's because you're very outspoken. If someone's rubbish, you will tell them. If a marketed effect is rubbish, you will tell them. You don't hold back. Your honesty does get you into trouble. And this is why people had their reservations of me going into business with you. But it's been smooth sailing for me thus far.
Oh, there you go. That's cool. I'm glad about that. And one last question for you, Steve.
Yeah.
This is a question I ask everybody on this. When I interview somebody, I always ask the question, what's next? And the reason I say that is because what's on your bucket list? You have achieved so much. And I'll tell the same thing to you. I'll say the same thing to you that I said to Sean Farquhar last week. If you never performed again, if you never released another magic trick again, your legacy is set. It absolutely is. You know, you have won so many competitions. You've done so much with the Magic Circle. You've performed, you know, you performed in cabaret shows all over the world. You've done it. You've been there. You've released so much amazing commercial magic. You know, you're constantly reinventing yourself. Snuggles the Clown, Misdirection, Phantasmagoria. You're always looking for that next thing. What, outside of Phantasmagoria and De La Shop, I know there's going to be other stuff that you're thinking about. What's next?
That's a hard one to answer, actually, because I do have ideas and things in mind that are both magic, well, mentalism and non-work related. So I've got other business ideas and stuff like that. But my main focus, literally where my brain is completely and utterly at, is Phantasmagoria, because that is not, I don't just see that as just the immediate future. I hope to still be doing Phantas with you in 10 years time. Mm-hmm. So the distant future is still that. And I want other projects, and I've got other ideas. There's other decks of cards I want to release. It's more stuff, even though it'll obviously make me money, it's more stuff to improve what other people are doing. So prop wise, I'm so obsessed with everything being high quality. I mean, I will always buy the best props. And then if I'm producing a prop, I try and make it immense quality. I want stuff you buy from me to last. I want it to be good value. So my brain is always reinventing old stuff that's out there. But honestly, and I'm not just saying this because you're the interviewer, but Phantasmagoria for me is kind of the only headspace I've got at the moment.
Which is great. And I know two things about you. I know, one, if you put your mind to something, you do it 100%. It's either all or nothing for you.
Pretty much.
Yeah, I know that. Wherever it is, Deladec, Phantasmagoria, it's either. I remember when we were first meeting up about Phantasmagoria, you were like, let's meet up again. I'm like, dude, I'm so busy. So it doesn't matter. Drop what you're doing.
I don't know how you found the time running the companies you run. It's like, well, I remember every time I turned up to have a meeting with you, you were on the phone booking gigs. So people that have never been to your office, they don't understand that you've always got three phones and you've always got three people on the end booking in gigs for people. It's quite incredible to see. So often I was given a coffee and told to wait 10 minutes while you booked in like 10 gigs.
Yes, that sounds about right. But the other thing is, as well as putting 100% in, you talk about me running a business, you have an incredible business brain. You don't just try something if you don't think it's going to work. Everything that you've done is successful. And the reason it stops is because you've decided to stop it, not because it hasn't worked. Look at Misdirection. You decided to stop that. It didn't run its course. You decided to stop it, and that's fine. Look at Snuggles the Clown. Look at everything that you've done. A lot of people don't realize you had a very successful vaping business.
Oh God, yeah, I did, didn't I? For years, yeah.
Ridiculously successful vaping business. You were wholesaling everywhere, and that stopped because you decided to, you know, stop it. Not because it wasn't successful. You know, I remember you telling me about that. I'm like, are you nuts?
Yeah.
But it's because, and I think people need to understand, you are such a very clever, shrewd business person who has an unbelievable ability to spot niches and go 100% in and make them successful.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how to react to that. That's really nice to hear, Craig. Thank you.
But it's true. You can't deny that everything I've said is true. I'm not just giving you my opinion. I'm giving you facts here that just...
Well, do you know what's funny? I mean, if I was talking about the proper future, but this could only happen if I won the Euro Millions, right? Mm-hmm. Or became super mega rich somehow. Me and Stephen, my partner, always plan a place called Delaville. This is going to sound really egotistical. Now, I don't have an ego, but
I love it already.
I would love to open and run a full entertainment village. Right, which would include a magic theatre and different bars that are themed to different types of illusion and stuff. And we always talk about this in such detail, even down to the fittings and the fixtures. We talk about it as if it will one day happen. So if I ever won the Euro Millions and had like 67 million pounds, Delaville would happen. It would happen slowly, but it would happen. So I wish I was a spaceman kind of thinking, but it's something that I still have my brain thinking about a little bit.
That's amazing. You know, I would be there in a heartbeat, man. That would be
so good. And I'd do you half price entry, so it'd be fine.
That's what friends are for. I got one last question for you, actually, that's just literally, I was going to wrap this all up, but I have got one last question for you that I think would be very useful to speak about. You and Stephen, you've mentioned your partner several times, you and Stephen, you have an amazing relationship. I know you both personally. Yeah. You guys are such an amazing couple. How do you, and this is a question that comes up on the channel a lot, so I'm going to ask it you, how do you balance, because you travel all over the UK performing, mm-hmm. and you can be very, very busy. You know, I know how busy you are, especially December and summer. And when you're not busy, you're busy doing other projects. How do you balance that family time with magic and make sure that they both kind of coalesce?
That's one of the hardest things about being busy. I mean, it's weird to say, but lockdown, I've kind of appreciated the extra time it's given me to spend with Stephen and our rats. So I am very much a family man. So I have been offered the opportunity to go and work in Dubai for 3 weeks. I've been offered the opportunity to interview for cruise ship jobs and things. But I actually care more about having a stable relationship than I do about going away for weeks at a time. So that might be my only downfall. But the other thing is, we keep very close friends, like yourself and Sarah. We just have people like you that we meet up with, but it's not like every week. It can be a few months at a time. And that means that when we're not meeting our few friends that we have, we can spend all that time together. And the great thing about Stephen is he is learning magic himself. And even passed his interview for the Wolverhampton Circle of Magicians and is a fully fledged member of that, which is my local and a fantastic magic society. So he has an interest. He comes to Blackpool every year. He buys magic when he's there for himself. He's always practicing, always improving. So now we have this interest that when we got together, we didn't realize we'd share. So having built that together, that's also wonderful.
That's amazing. That's great. And you guys are awesome. You really are.
Ah, so are you guys.
Thank you so
much. Stop it.
Yeah. It's a love fest. Seriously, Steve, thank you so much for coming on the channel.
Thanks for having me.
You were amazing, and I knew you would be. And if you want to connect with Steve, like I say, down below, delashop.co.uk.
.uk.
Where is it? Sorry?
.uk.
.uk. I don't know. Teleshop.uk. Are you on Facebook as well? I need, not personally, but with...
Yeah, my like work page is Steve Della Magician.
There you go.
And then I've got Della Dex. So if you want to know just about the playing cards that I release and am going to release, then follow Della Dex on Facebook.
Perfect. So connect with Steve with all of that. Make sure that you check his website out. And if you haven't already got a Night Flight deck, get one. I'm going to put a link at the top right here.
So hey.
The review that me and Ryland did. And then I'm going to put another link right here. And that's going to be a link directly through to Steve's shop. So have a look at those. And yeah. Who have I got next Tuesday? Well, next Tuesday, I've got somebody else I've got a very personal relationship with, but in a very different way. Next Tuesday, I'm going to be here with Justin Miller. And if anybody knows my history with Justin, sparks will fly, I guarantee it. Ooh. Yeah, last time I was on camera with Justin, we were ripping each other a new assholes. That's going to be a very interesting conversation. So make sure you check out that next Tuesday. I'm going to be back tomorrow with Ryland with another Magic review. But one more time, Steve, thank you so much.
Thank you, Craig.
Guys, have a good day. See you again. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic, magic.
Be
magic.
Sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel.
Magic TV.
Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV. Or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.